it stopped at 10 in verbal highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. The guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
I don't write poetry for poets. I write for people that picked up their first book at 25 and now dream in Technicolor. I write for women who quote Aesop Rock and like to fuck into oblivion. I write for my parents, hoping these words will make up for their son being a 30-year-old kitchen hand. I write for academics so my syntax can bitch slap preconceptions off their smug faces like a free verse diss track. I write for dead legends. My better work is flowers on the graves of my heroes. I write for every teacher who treated me like a retard. Now applause and admiration is my A-plus average. I write for Auckland City, the alcoholic mother who inspires me with extremes of love and abuse. I write for minimum wage space monkeys to distract them from their suicide instincts. I write for children not yet born, markers of madness past. I write for you, the hypothetical audience constantly nagging me like drunken lovers. I write for the voice in my head that screams over television and gossip. I write for my ex-lovers in the hope that I can whitewash my past. I write for my dreams, setting them free like Ritalin babies in a candy store. I write for angels, snapshots of the homeland while they rest worn wings. I write for simians sick of scraping sidewalks of septic knuckles. I write for the beasts that keep nightmares jumping. I write for my friends documenting their acts of survival. I write for my shadow drunk on the fumes of my death wish. I write for drunks and addicts. I write for buoyancy. I write for redemption. I write for ego. I write for pussy. I write for myself. I write for all of the above, but I do not write poetry for poets.
Right, welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted weekly from a kitchen bench in Kingston, Auckland, New Zealand. Myself, Lewis, the host, bringing you guests like the gentleman we just heard recite one of his poems, Mr. Dominic Hoey, a.k.a. stage name Tourette's. I've been a fan since I came back to Auckland, to New Zealand, 2007, 2008. And as I talked to him about in the podcast, I was kind of a little uninspired by what I saw around me creatively, but it could have been my headspace at the time. And then a buddy took me out to a gig, I think at Whammy. Dom was on the stage, and I was like, shit, yes. This guy's good. He's a performer. He's an amazing wordsmith. He's a social commentator. He's an agitator. He's just one out of the box talented individual, and all those other things I just laid forth about the man. We talk about his development over the past few years. He calls himself sometimes rapper and poet now. Of course, that was a spoken word piece, but I can just kind of tell from the feel of it that, you know, perhaps his kind of messages have changed a little then. But that's a body of work, right? And that's a killer piece. I listened to the album that's from a lot. I actually played a couple of poems to people I've taught over the years in relation to topics we're kind of mulling over in class. I think it was called Talent. We Don't Need No Stinking Talent. I should probably check these things before I come on. But if you go to Tourette's at Bandcamp, you'll find Dom's albums. And there's a mixture of music joints and pure spoken word joints. And that one's a pure spoken word album. I really like every single poem on that. So I'll leave you, you know, I don't want to talk too much about what we chat about. Otherwise, what's the point in continuing on after this, right? But politics do come up, and I never set out for this to be a podcast, you know, heavily weighing in on that topic. I don't consider myself a commentator to be able to publicly commentate, perhaps to the level of depth and knowledge and understanding and nuance that a number of my friends could. But the topic keeps coming up, and of course it was going to come up this week, because a huge theme of Dom's work is how current kind of political and power and social systems operate such that certain people are kind of fucked around to put you know, no finer point on it. And so things come up in the podcast, such lofty topics as Marxism, neoliberalism, and capitalism. If you're letting out a wee Homer, no. Fare you well, my friend. Fare you well. I just want to clarify a few things around those topics because I don't bring people on. I've said it's a conversation, not an interview, and I've also said I'm not interested in kind of interrogating people about their beliefs and a lot of Don's beliefs. His core sort of concerns and outlook are very similar to mine, but we probably differed a little bit of nuance throughout the podcast. So I sort of went away and thought about that, and I was like, well, I'm kind of, as well as putting guests on the record, I'm putting myself on the record as well. So it's sort of nice to sort of say where I sit as well. The left-wing, right-wing thing keeps coming up on the podcast. I'm pretty sure y'all know where I sit on that, but I'm even getting sick now of that because it's become so factioned in terms of, well, you're that and I'm this. So, you know, we can't tiptoe around the treetops. we can't do stuff together, man. If we're talking, you know, if something like Marxism comes up, which Don says he's a, you know, fervent advocate of that system, hopefully one day existing, and I do believe it, you know, part of Marx's thing was that one day topple capitalism. Well, we kind of need to unify to begin with, right? Because we do talk about where the democratic systems, because they are a bit bung at the moment, will eventually fall and make way for something else. And to the Marxism thing, yeah, back to my perspective on things, I think it's a great, I like it as a system on a kind of romantic level, but whether it could realistically be a working system and you know, with human nature is another thing. And funnily enough, we talk about that in another context in the podcast, the fact that kind of, you know, 5% of shitty people ruin it for the rest of us, in terms of perhaps if we were to instigate a system like that, things like kind of taking the person, taking more than you need, and human greed and theft and desire for power and, you know, essentially people going feral. That's it's not a very scientific or academic comment on Marxism, but hey, we're just here chatting, man. And as related to that, the neoliberalism comes up, and often that's a term I think used in error. Well, not if not an error, with good intentions sometimes, but as a sort of a blanket term for a number of things, which sometimes is and it isn't. Now, I'm not saying Dom, or accusing Dom of that at all, quite the opposite. He's a very well-read, well-considered man. I've heard him discuss a number of things around such themes. Heard it in his work and heard it on his podcast and so on. But where was I going with that? Oh, yes, because it kind of obviously totally relates to this notion of capitalism as well. So where perhaps a pure Marxist, someone like Dom perhaps suggested he was, would be an advocate of the complete destruction of the capitalist system, there are aspects of capitalism that I'm okay with. I'm not anti-capitalism, but speaking to the neoliberal buzz, that system and that style of, you know, economic management and that what would you call it? What was it originally? It was an academic idea brought to governments in the Western world throughout the early 80s. That side of it, that net, you know, the whole net result of neoliberal policies being instigated, that's capitalism gone too far. So not a fan of that. Not a fan of what it's doing to our societal structure, not a fan of what it's doing to our poorest, not a fan of what it's often doing to our environment, not a fan of how economic policy and economic ways of measuring things often take precedent over other measures. Hello, Bhutan, who have a happiness index rather than a GDP and so on and so forth. I also think, you know, often people say, oh, the whole 80s Labour government thing, the whole neoliberal thing, bad, full stop. Well, I'm just old enough to remember that kind of weird, almost Soviet era New Zealand we lived in under Muldoon. And, you know, it's nice having a bit of choice. But yeah, it went too far. And, you know, a number of commentators will say that who are far more qualified to commentate than I am. such as Jeffrey Palmer, just a really interesting interview on RNZ, which you can check, a video interview. Sort of like, you know, Roger went too far. Please like and share, get in touch with that good stuff. I'm on Verbal Hires on the Twitter, Verbal Hires Podcast on the Facebook, verbalhires.com on the internet, Verbal Hires on the iTunes. Like, subscribe, comment. Thank you. See you next week. 21st, by the way, the podcast turned 21 today. Yay!
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Hires.
Seen one of these before?
Yeah.
check.
Yeah, one, two.
Hello.
Hi. So recap on that, we're just talking about how not to be an arsehole and its unfortunate demise, which I think is due mainly to Todd
moving away and
gapping it.
Yeah, but also I think it did its dash. I mean, we did 52 episodes.
Did you do 52?
Yeah, and so that was kind of like, oh well.
So is that like one a week? So you did it, you committed to a year?
Pretty much. It went on for a bit longer because we had, you know, sort of breaks and I went overseas. But, yeah, I learned a lot. I mean, if you listen to the first one and you listen to the last one, the fucking development and just my skills as an interviewer, you know, it was pretty dramatic.
Yeah, like, you know, a couple of exes have said to me, you never listen. And actually, that's ironic to start with because I remember them saying that, so obviously I was listening. But my point being with the podcast is, even in just... Actually, you're here for... this is the podcast 21st. Thanks.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's episode 21. But same thing, even in 20 or 21, I'm like, in the first few, I was kind of like trying to get on in there. And yeah, I'm learning the to and fro thing a bit better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're thinking about launching another one?
Yeah, I've got a couple of different ideas, but it's sort of pretty rough at the moment. But a spin-off would potentially interested in hosting one, and then I've got this other one. I bought one of those digital recorders.
Yeah.
You know, little, what are they called?
Zoom or something?
Yeah. So I was thinking about maybe doing one, because I'm always touring and travelling around and just talking to people. And yeah, I thought it could be quite cool to do one where you sort of talk to people that you're really close with and then talk about your relationship with them, and thought that could be quite nice, you know?
I thought about one like that. I was actually more like, when I was thinking about kind of TV show ideas that kind of tie in with like new media, and I was thinking it'd be out of it to do a show like where you went round and visited all your Facebook friends, like whether or not they were friends or not, awkward thing of the person that you kind of knew, the girl from primary school that added you, even though you talked twice when you were in standard three, you know, anyway, yeah. Oh, that's a great idea. And I reckon that one will be like, because I don't know how you guys did how not to be an arsehole, but what I try to do is, it's kind of warts and all, so unless you do something today, like fall off the chair, or I completely lose my train of thought, That's probably the only time I'll kind of edit bits out.
With How Not to Be an Asshole, we did it like, if someone sort of said something which would be very damaging to them,
yeah,
but they didn't realise, do you know what I mean?
No, that as well. I was digest, yeah, that's yeah. The main thing, yeah.
So we had one guy and he just said something that, he was just clumsy with his language, you know, yeah. he's not a feminist or whatever, and so he said some stuff that I knew would really damage him. And we had to talk about it, but then it's like, rather than put all that in, I was just like, we might as well just take it out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he didn't get the fucking how serious what he had said was.
Yeah. And 2,000 listens or whatever is
yeah, you
a lot
throw
of listens.
Someone under the bus.
Yeah.
And obviously if someone is yeah. just like a straight out misogynist or a straight out racist, then let them hang themselves.
But hey, thanks for coming in for, you know, you're like, hey, thanks for coming in and volunteering your time.
Yeah.
We're just going to make you a social pariah from here on in. Okay. But I was going to say with the other one, just quickly to close off. Yeah. Like, so the punchline of that was kind of, you know, I love this. Like, it's just raw. I might take a minute or whatever out, bang it up. But it sounds like that one you're thinking of will be kind of a fun editing job as well, like trying to put it all to kind of almost storyboard it after you've talked to all these people and making an hour or whatever. Hey, anyway, welcome. I better, this is the obligatory call of honor for your achievements. My guest is a poet, by his own admission, now sometimes rapper, which we'll get to at some point. What do you call a description word before the... no, hang on, what's sometimes and sometimes rapper? I don't know verbs and nouns, that's a adjective sometimes.
Sometimes a rapper, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we'll get to the use of that new adjective later on. Musician, podcaster, teacher, youth mentor for young people kind of struggling with the regular education system, kind of getting their heads around new ways to do things and approach things. And a writer, which is quite poignant at the moment because you have just recently finished your first novel, Iceland, and you're also soon to launch, speaking of teaching and so on, mentoring, a series of writing workshops in Wellington and Auckland.
So I've been doing the ones in Auckland for about a year.
Welcome, Dominic. Tourette's.
Thank you. So I've been doing the ones in Auckland for about a year. I've done six of them. I'm running the sixth one at the moment. And then I'm going to do my first one in Wellington, which will be cool.
Yeah. Poetry, writing in general.
Just creative writing in general, because I feel like the main... So what we do is we go over the fundamentals of creative writing. So like good work practice, good editing technique, good structure, figurative language. And I think that those skills are... applicable across the board. Do you know what I mean? So like for myself, it's like, you know, obviously I started out as a rapper who wrote poetry, but then I've, you know, written a novel and I've done screenplays, and it's sort of like there's nuances to each genre or each discipline, but generally it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. So kind of like the basic fundamental kind of structure or building block, not structure, but the building blocks and the disciplines are the same, but it's kind of where you go with each of them.
Yeah.
A two-sentence poem compared to a novel. How long did it take to do the novel, man?
It took 5 years, but a lot of that was because of... I kind of gave up at one point because it got rejected so many times, and then it got accepted, and then there was a lot of... The publisher just took forever. And so really, I think it could have been done in three.
Yeah.
It's quite crazy because... I'm such a different writer than I was 5 years ago, so it's quite weird having this thing, which is sort of like it's like a time capsule in a way.
Can you feel the change through that time?
Oh no, I've definitely gone through and made sure. Yeah. I mean, so like obviously I've done lots of changes as I've developed and learned things, but there's the plot and the overall structure is pretty, you know, like so you can't really change the overall feel of it without just ripping the whole thing apart.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's exciting, man.
But that's crazy. So for a man who, you know, who has been, you know, a kind of crafter of words since, from what I kind of read when I had a look, you know, at least intermediate in age, if not earlier, why the last particular 5 years do you notice that your writing's changed heaps? Or is that always the case and it's kind of more noticeable because you've got this one project?
For better or for worse, sometimes I think it's maybe a bad thing. I generally, once I master something, like a technique or a certain style, I throw it away.
Yeah.
It's always changing. And because of that, sometimes you kind of regress as well because you go off on these weird tangents. You're like, oh. You know, especially when I listen to old songs, and I'm like, oh, that I should probably do that again because that was really clever, you know?
Yeah. I suppose it's a mix of like, yeah, I should do that again. Oh, I'm glad I stopped doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
But the burning it down thing, man, I think that's probably just to keep creativity going, right? Like if you kind of settle on, I mean, some people I'm sure settle on the same kind of shtick and do it to eternity and whatever the field. But to me, that's just constantly seeing where you can kind of go with things, surely. We'll get back to the novel later, but I base these around your sort of coming on it, up your background and stuff. And I know, like, you've talked about it a bit before because it's a theme of your work, but, hey, let's go again. Growing up, man, like, family, Auckland, talk a little bit about your youth.
I talk about it a lot, but I grew up in Grey Lynn.
Yeah.
We were pretty poor. I was dyslexic, so I had a shit time at school, a lot of bullying, a lot of violence with the teachers. And so, yeah, school was a pretty shitty time until I got to Western Springs, and then I sort of started to meet, I guess, more like-minded people and stuff.
Yeah.
And got into punk rock, started rapping. I just sort of, I guess, found myself, you know, for want of a better word. And then I went to Metropolitan College, for the listeners that don't know, that's an alternative school. We didn't have to go to school. The students could vote on what they wanted the money to be spent on. And so that was really incredible because that, like...
Is that still around?
No, it got closed down because, you know, it's a pretty crazy idea. But it was incredible for me because it meant that I was able to focus on my writing and making music. And then when I left school, I'd already been kind of doing it for a couple of years when most people were just starting, really.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
So we used the school funds to put on shows and to do poetry nights and stuff. So I sort of, you kind of had that head start. And a lot of like really successful artists like Askew and Deos and Misery and stuff all came from there. And,
oh, really?
Six Owl.
Because I'm not an Aucklander, but I do know, you know, some of that narrative of different schools. I talked a bit about it with Slave, like the difference between, you know, I likened Western Springs. That's where he went, eh? Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure it's Western Springs.
I think
it's
Selwyn.
I was Selwyn. Yeah. But we're talking about how those two schools are kind of similar to.
Yeah, they were at the time.
Well, I went to Welly High, and kind of Welly High and Onslow, if you don't know, are a similar buzz in Wellington, if you don't kind of fit into that throw a ball round kind of as the main thing. But I was going to say, like, so if you're at Western Springs, I mean, that was pretty sort of progressive at the time. Why didn't you just stick on with things there? How'd the other school come up?
It was kind of progressive, but at the same time, there was, like, this weird thing where, because I was white, I think the teachers thought that I was, even though I dressed like shit, that I was wealthy. And so you'd kind of, because there were a lot of, like, kind of wealthy, spoiled kids there. And so I got kind of treated like them. And then, like, really rebelled against that. And then also, like, I don't know. Like, I guess I felt like I knew that what I wanted to do even then. Like, I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I was really dyslexic. And so it was just this real, I was really frustrated. And so I guess I kind of did a lot of dumb shit, like throwing chairs around and just not turning up and smoking weed at school. And just, you know, so basically it got to the point where they were like, look, we just don't really want you here, which is actually really illegal, I realize now. But they were like, if you come back, we're going to make your life hell. And so me and a whole bunch of other friends.
So like an unofficial expulsion, hey buddy, come over here.
We didn't have anything to expel us for.
Yeah.
You know, we just kind of like,
We just kind of don't like your vibe. We've got nothing to pin on you.
Yeah, and I think that I think it's a much better school now, but I think at the time, it wasn't, academically, it wasn't a very great school. I mean, I didn't fucking learn anything, you know. I literally did not learn how to use a comma until I taught myself, like, you know, my early 20s, because I was like, oh, I better learn how to do this. You know what I mean?
So if you read a sentence from you, even though you wanted to be a writer all that time, would be like...
Yeah, I don't know about any of that shit. Well, because I was writing poetry, so it was kind of, I was using line breaks instead.
Yeah.
But yeah, so went to Metro and then started rapping all the time. Because
what are you? You're like, you'd be a 76 or 77 baby, or around my age. 77, yeah. So we've got similar memories of the school system and stuff. I mean, it was, I think you could still legally hit someone until I was about third form.
Yeah, there's a lot of violence. And
schools have changed, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy to think about, you know, because I think about when I see 8-year-olds now and I think about the fact that our teacher used to beat the living shit out of us at their age, and it's just crazy, man.
Really beat the living shit, though?
Yeah.
Really?
Like, fuck yeah.
Like an inquiry that never happened style.
Kick you in the head, throw you against the wall.
Whoa.
Drag you around by your hair. Yeah, it was full on.
Fire up. I don't want to go too far down that route, but yeah, I'm kind of sorry to hear that. Bro.
No, it's all right. I mean,
it's like I say, it sounds like some education department inquiry that never happened.
I talk about it in my work all the time now, but yeah. I think because it was a really low, this is grade in primary, and it was a really low decile school, no one cared, you know what I mean? And like, I mean, sometimes I actually got a poem about it where one time this kid, I won't say his name, but he got the shit beat out of him, he left, and he came back with his dad, and his dad beat the shit out of our teacher, and... Then the beating stopped for a little while then.
So just a lawless, like, I mean, even that you talk about the decile thing and the money thing and stuff, like, bro, I've talked to people about, just in general, sure, there's that side of it's huge, but just New Zealand in general then, yeah, there was a bit more of a lawless kind of buzz like that. I always cracked up at, there was something I read of yours where you talked about, because when I was growing up, it was the random... kind of rabid dog was a thing, right?
Yeah.
There's some piece you wrote where, like, you'd leave the house and go one way, the dog would leave the other house and go the other way.
Then
you kind of come back at the end of the day. Like, there's something I really missed about the freedom of that time, but I totally relate at the same time to the kind of crazy...
Well, the instability of
it. Instability of it, yeah. But at the same time, the whole helicopter parenting thing and so on now... That freaks me out too, you know
but
what I mean?
I don't think it needs to be each extreme.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, I mean, I think that it could have been possible for them to put some money into the education system to them. You know what I mean? Like, why couldn't Greyland Primary have the funding it has now? Like, I mean, now it's one of the top primary schools in New Zealand. So
is it? Right.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I hear. Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's no reason for that. I mean, like, I've talked about this before, but I remember I went out to MIT to do a workshop out there, and I'm on the bus, and I'm going through Otahuhu, and it's just as simple as, like, the bus stops out there obviously haven't been painted in a long time. And it sounds really like, who gives a fuck about the bus stops, but just, like, you know, you rebuild all the bus stops in Central City, and you make them all nice, and you don't even bother to fucking paint the ones out there. And what is that saying to the people that live in that community? Like, you know what I mean? And those things just build up.
And what is it presenting them at every single level of their existence every day when everything is, like, snapped in half, not painted?
Because I think, like, you know, if I hadn't grown up in a neighborhood that got gentrified, you know, and if I hadn't been white, I mean, you know, like, because a lot of my Polynesian friends were just kind of like, you know, they all left and stuff. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. There's no fucking way. Like, there's no way that from my education and the way that people would just thought about the world. I mean, I didn't even know anyone that went overseas till I was 17, you know. Yeah. So, like, the idea that you would be an artist, it was just, like, crazy, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you got me thinking, like, I don't even know, like, when I was a kid in Wellie, whether there was such a divide as there is here now. But did it feel like there was a huge divide across Auckland even back then, like,
with
between
class,
rich, poor, class areas sectioned off one of the other? Like, well, this is a question. I'm not saying to you this is the case. I don't know, because I'm not, like I say, I'm not born and bred Aucklander, but from what I can work out, it's way more fractured and factioned than it was back then.
No, it wasn't like it is now. I mean, like, Ponsonby, there was still a lot of really wealthy people, and there were a few in Greyland, but, like, we went to school together at Western Springs, so we'd go around to their house. And I mean, the first time I went to someone's house, it was, you know, really, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, it was crazy, man.
Yeah.
You know, and they were probably just upper middle class. Yeah. You know, they probably never went, like, millionaires or anything. But, like, but people did mix like that. And I think much more so, like, the ethnic makeup of the schools and stuff. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the schools are like now here, but, you know.
Well, I think that battle for, I think when they put those, like, there was no numbers for shit when I grew up for schools. I think even when you put that kind of, like, you know, even they might have the best intention for it, but once you start giving people numbers for where they are and people scramble to be in this number and it's, I can't be there, then even the education system's throwing up these unintentional sections and walls.
Totally.
You know, I'm sure they had a good reason for it, but that's funny you say that. Yeah, I remember first year at uni, or maybe even a bit later, like, going to a friend's place in Wadestown. Wellington's tiny.
Yeah.
It's not like Lyell Bay where I grew up, that far away. But it was the same thing. Like, not saying I didn't grow up in poverty at all, but I was a pretty poor area. but I had no idea there was a way of living kind of markedly different to what I'd known.
Yeah.
And same thing, just going to someone's house. It's like, we got a wine cellar and there's a lift that goes down to it and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like,
yeah. And I think, like, I was really lucky because had I not met those people, even though there was obviously a lot of shame around being so poor, and not that they, not from them, it was just from me, you know. But if I had not met those people, you know, like, I would have never thought, like, I could do what I'm doing now, because a lot of, you know, they...
No, I hear what you were saying before, yeah.
Yeah, because their friend, you know, like, their parents were often creative.
Yeah.
They had been overseas.
Yeah.
They had, like, you know, they were going to go to university, which is something that I hadn't even thought about, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, is your, because I've seen your mum at shows and so on. Is your dad still around, Dom? Or I don't really know much about him.
Yeah, so he was a late life academic. So he had about 40. He started going to university. And,
holla.
Yeah. And so he became a PhD in sociology.
Yeah.
And then he's quit. He just couldn't. He's a very outspoken, very political person. And he just, the politics of it kind of got to him. And he's like, fuck this, and quit. And now he's living in a caravan up north, which sounds grimmer than it is. Like, it's a really amazing bit of land. And,
yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he's a pretty incredible man, and that's another reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, because.
What was he doing when you were a kid then, to go from that to before academia?
Just on the dole. Yeah. He's a postie for a while.
Artist as well?
No, he's much more like, much more into like, like that academic world. Because like, even before he was an academic, like he hadn't been to university or anything, but he was really into reading academic texts. And
yeah.
Just sort of, like both him and my mum really taught me like to question shit, you know, so you'd be watching the news and they'd be like, that's bullshit, this is what's really going on, and you know, like the Cold War was happening then, and you know, it was really cool at school to be really pro-America, and they're like, fuck America, you know. And
so even in the low socioeconomic area, you guys were the curious, slightly eccentric family, if you put it that way.
We were, but there were other families like that, because yeah. I think like you know, like that. There, you know, had been that big Springbok movement. Yeah. There had been like the sort of Rainbow Warrior thing had happened, and I think that galvanized a lot of the left. And this is pre Rogernomics as well.
Yeah.
So I think this is sort of before the unions were totally broken, before yeah. Beneficiaries were vilified like they are now. So I think there was still that sort of working class pride to an extent.
Yeah.
And it was a real community on our street, you know, like. You know, like everyone would sort of wander, because there was no fences, everyone just wander through each other's backyards.
Yeah,
and,
the dogs included.
Yeah. Fucking hounds.
Like, I don't know, I'm really hesitant to, you know, that whole, this generation had this and that, your generation's this and da-da-da-da, but we lived, I reflect on this, man, like we lived through an interesting period of time, we have lived through a really interesting period of change in New Zealand that I think, you know, my students who are, let's say, 18 to 20 now, I'm sure they've seen some crazy shit happen in the world and so on since they've grown up, but I don't think they've lived through such an extreme period of change as we have in this country. Would you kind of...
Well, I think that they have, but they probably were just born into it, so they maybe aren't aware that this sort of neoliberal sort of paradigm that we're existing in now, like how...
Yeah, so they didn't live through it.
Yeah. How historically recent it is. But, you know, like, I mean, some of the most sort of outspoken activists I know are in that millennial age group, you know.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I'm hesitant to kind of go...
Well, I just think every generation, the generation before is like, they're just lazy, useless bastards.
That wasn't what I was saying.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying you were, but you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that's so counterproductive because, you know, like... I had a conversation with someone recently because they're like, fucking baby boomers, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, man, my dad is fucking, you know, was an activist and he's always done the right thing sort of politically. I know he's living in a caravan up north and my mum doesn't, you know, she sort of owns a tiny little property.
Yeah.
I mean, they're doing all right. They're not, you know, but at the same time, they're not fucking owning multiple houses in Grey Lynn and it's extorting.
No, you're right. And you're right. And I think that's people pinning the exactly what you're talking about before, an economic theory, you know, born in the US and that traveled here, you know, that made its way fiercely into policy really quickly in the early 80s, and that a bunch of that generation have extorted to the hilt. You're right. It's like pinning that small bunch's actions on a whole generation is kind of shitty.
Always, you know? Fuckwits.
That's what I just said to you. That's just what I said to you.
And there's always kind people.
Yeah, there is
throughout history. That's and it's right. Just,
I mean, that's something I mean, not at the extreme of lizard people, obviously, and absolute nonsense. But the more I've kind of seen and heard and read in the last few years, the more I've realized that. It's often a certain kind of murky person that wants a really high level of power, right? I kind of didn't want to believe that for years.
Oh, of course.
Though. I thought it was, you know, I was a bit more idealistic, but...
But if you want to be, if you want to get into these positions of power, I mean, obviously they suit certain personality types and they're not usually kind, generous people.
And you got to have this is a metaphor, it could be literal as well, you got a body count behind you, you know? I can't say I've got a body count behind me. You know, maybe that's why things take me longer than those people, you know?
Oh, totally. I mean, I've even seen it totally, you know, like that is a microcosm of the music industry. I mean, it's like most people that are successful, they did what was best for them, regardless of who helped them or regardless of what that caused the people around them.
Yeah.
What
do you think when that story broke about, I forget the artist's name, it's like a big pop artist, just getting ruthlessly ripped off by that guy last year. Do you remember that?
Oh, the manager.
Yeah, just actual proper fraud. Like,
yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of. Is it Avalanche City?
No, that's an overseas band. Was it Avalanche City? It was a solo dude.
Yeah, it's Avalanche.
Avalanche City.
I think it was that one. But anyway, yeah. I'm not a big fan of his music. But yeah, it's terrible. I mean, you know, and he obviously worked hard for that shit. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing, though. That's the thing with the music industry, and maybe other industries are the same. I guess I'm going to find out in the publishing industry. But, you know, there's just so many people willing to fuck people over if they can, and there's so little money. It's like, well, why don't you just go fuck over people in the business world?
Yeah,
that's what it's there for,
Why did you choose us?
Yeah.
Why did you choose us?
Talk
about finding a publisher, man. Like, I don't even, you know, the whole book publishing world, I could talk the music business with way more fluency than that. Like, what was that process? You're saying it was getting frustrating and so on. Is it just submitting the manuscript and seeing if they accept it to begin with? Or
yeah, well, what happened was I sort of got to the third draft and I was like, this is amazing because, you know, like, you got to think, I went from nothing to the third draft, right? And in retrospect, the third draft was terrible.
Yeah.
But, you know what I mean? Like, it was so, it's like when you record a song, when it goes from an idea to a demo. I mean, that's such a big jump. It's a much bigger jump than a demo to a mastered thing.
Yeah.
That you kind of can get lost in that. Yeah. And so I sent it out and it got rejected by a few people. And then I kind of gave up for about 6 months. And then I got this email. I was actually in Berlin. And I got this email saying, oh, we like the novel. Here's some suggested changes. And all the changes were really good. And yeah, and so
you're saying that you could tell someone had taken the care and kind of got what you were doing if they'd suggested changes and so on.
Yeah, well, they just said they wanted. I mean, no one else had offered to publish it. Yeah. And then, of course, as soon as I signed that contract, there's like two other publishers come along and like, oh, we want to do it. But they've done an amazing job. Steele Roberts.
Where are they from?
They're from Wellington.
Yeah, yeah.
But Sarah, I don't know her last name, but who did the editing? Did a real incredible job.
It's called Iceland, so yeah. I'm assuming it's based on that. You went over there to write, right? But is it fiction or non-fiction?
Totally fiction. It's set in Grey Lynn.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like about the idea that places are made up by the people and their memories and our collective memories of a place.
Yeah.
And then what happens when those people are forced out and then that memory starts to fade but people are still living in that. So it's set in Grey Lynn like 5 or 6 years ago with this group of artists sort of trying to make their way.
And how did you manage to get the name on it? Like, in terms of Iceland, is there a link to... is it just because that's where I wrote it?
No. Well, I mean, obviously that influenced it, but it was like the main character, the main female character, there's two main characters. She wants to get out of Auckland. She wants to travel. And she basically, at one point, they're talking, and he's never been overseas, and she's sort of well-traveled, and she's saying... I want to go to Iceland. He's like, where's that? And she's like, that's as far as you can get from here. And then there's other reasons why it's called Iceland, but I don't want to ruin the...
Yeah, no spoilers.
Ruin the plot.
Don't want to ruin the plot, lose the plot. Because you're quite well-travelled, right? You've done shows, quite a lot of spots around...
In later life, yeah. I was actually talking to Tom Scott about this.
I've got to travel more, but yeah.
Yeah, like we were talking about how neither of us travelled until we're 28. I mean, I'd been to Australia and travelled to New Zealand, but I'd never been anywhere else. Just... because, you know, like, I mean, for me, like, because I didn't know anyone had been overseas for so long, I didn't even think it was really possible. Like, it was kind of like walking into the television or something. Like, it was like...
Before you were 28.
Then I got to do this tour. And, of course, as soon as you go, you're like, oh, this is just another place.
Yeah.
I just
got to get in that tube and sit in it for a while and eat some bad food. And
but in the last 10 years, I've been really lucky and I've got to travel heaps and...
Is that just through people picking you up for spoken word shows and so on, or of your own volition, or a bit of both?
And I think, like, I've been so lucky. I've had all these really generous people that have helped me out my friends...
I don't know if it's lucky, man. I think it's because you're fucking good at what you do.
But you know, there's lots of people that are good. It's just...
Yeah.
And I also would contend that I was probably good before 28 as well. But I think it's that thing that you know, like, that mind... set changed. And as soon as that mindset changed, then obviously the offers come. But you know,
The mindset of I'm not walking into the TV anymore.
Because
I was gonna say because you've you know, I've done a few cities and so on. I'm gonna do it, man. It's one of those things that on a you know, on a day when my serotonin's a little down or whatever, I'll just think about, oh, my friends. Facebook's the worst for that for me, like for FOMO of just the travel. I'll do it. That's fine. As I say, I mean, I'm lucky. I've done more than a lot of people. What do they say? Like, there's some crazy statistic that, like, 70% of Americans don't have a passport or something that. Anyway, to the travel thing, I asked about that, you know, because I kind of had deduced you'd done quite a few shows and traveled a few places, but was Iceland just a whole nother head trip in terms of
location? That was the first time I'd gone overseas. I went by myself.
Yeah.
Like, it was the first time I'd gone overseas, like, I guess, not to do shows.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Because you got a writer's scholarship or something, right?
I got a residency. And yeah. So basically what happened was my girlfriend of like 4 or 5 years broke up with me.
Yeah.
And I just put out an album and it completely flopped and we'd spent $10,000 on it and we'd spent 3 or 4 years making it. And so I was just like, man, what the fuck? And then my friend, her husband works for an airline and she was like, she could tell us, you know, obviously really depressed. And she was like, I can get you a cheap flight anywhere you want to go. Just tell me when to go. And I was like, I want to go to Iceland. And so, like, I just applied for these residencies. And, like, and I thought,
I'm getting as far away from this woman and this album as I can.
Yeah. And then I sort of thought, like, you know, like, I apply for the residency. And then maybe 3 months later, I hear back. Maybe 2 or 3 days later, I get an email saying, can you be here in like 2 months? So then I just crowdfunded and I went. And
Well, that's funny. I mean, shitty things to happen in a row. But then, you know, that whole kind of life falls into places for a reason, I guess. Like, you probably wouldn't have been able to go in 2 months if you still were with that long-term partner and the album was going really well. No. And so look where it's led.
It was a blessing in disguise, you know, because I was kind of like getting sick of rapping, but I didn't really know how to get out of it. And then also, like, I don't know if I would have had the guts to sort of just leave like that.
Yeah.
Like, it was a pretty crazy thing to do.
So sick of rapping, because I wanted to talk about that at some stage. Thanks. You know, you're saying former rapper, and I kind of get that with how I've changed my, you know, I'm still into all the same shit, but I've changed my trajectory quite a lot in the last few years. And so it could be any number of things, bro, and I'll leave it to you, but is it that you want to be more into the poetry? Is it being sick of late nights? Is it feeling a little too old for the scene now? Like, what's the former rapper buzz?
I think there's multiple things. I think, like, I just got sick of it, to be honest. I mean, I've been doing it since I wrote my first rap at 8, but, you know, I probably didn't start doing it all the time until I was about 16.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that was, like, at least 20 years of doing it. And I just got to the point where I could see that it wasn't going to go any further than it had. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that album that we did, Tiger Belly, that no one bought, I mean, that was sort of like...
It's not you, bro.
Oh, no.
It's people not buying albums.
I know. I'm still super proud of that. I mean, like, I put as much time into that as I did into the novel, which is a crazy thing, you know?
Yeah.
I just sort of felt like... This has run down its dash, and getting older. I mean, like, I was 34, and I was just kind of like...
No, you summed it up well. I had Paul Walsh in here last week, and he and I expressed the same thing about all our years DJing, that it was awesome. But then exactly what you said was what he kind of said, and I echoed with, was that it had reached a point where it could keep going at that point and keep going at that point, and it could probably do okay with it, but it hadn't gone to that other point, and then it's like, oh, I'll try this instead, and you know,
exactly. And then look what's happened since I've done the writing. It's awesome. It's really taken off, so probably should have done it a few years before.
But things happen when they happen. But back to the Iceland thing, like, I just picture, like, snow everywhere, creaky wooden door, you riding to your candlelight. I jest, but what was it like?
I was in summer, so it was okay.
Not like that at all.
It was like this outside all the time. Like, it never got dark.
Like that Robin Williams film, Insomnia.
So it was like that. But it was cold. So it never got really above 10 degrees. And I was in a little fishing village of about 400 people in the north.
Yeah.
And initially, I tried to sort of get along with people when I, you know, like... sort of made friends and even went on like some dates with people and stuff, but then
in a village of 400 you found some dates.
Well, you know, like, you're the new person and look like a fucking weirdo, but then after a while, I was like, I just got so into the novel that, like, I think for a week I didn't talk to anyone.
Yeah.
And then after that, I flew to London, and it was just so crazy, just going like just full on.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to, it took me about 3 days to sort of become normal again.
So how'd they put, so it was Iceland, someone, a group in Iceland that funded you, or someone in New Zealand?
So I crowdfunded. Yeah, so nice thing, they just give you the space.
They give you the space, that's what I'm saying. So what, they just pick some random, they pick some fishing village just to somewhere on the map and...
So it's an artist residency called Ness, and any artist listening, I definitely recommend you apply for it. It's really amazing. Yeah. They take 16 people every season. And there's an old fish processing plant, and they turned it into a studio, and wow. Then they've brought... houses around the village, so I think there's about 4 different houses.
Oh, so it wasn't just you in residence there?
No, there's other artists there.
Oh, that's cool. Where were they from?
A lot from America.
Yeah.
But there were, like, there's an Irish guy, there was some people from, I always get all the Scandinavian countries mixed up, but I think maybe Norway.
So it's not a case of better living through chemistry, but you've got this odd 24/7 sunlight thing. Like, how does that, well, when do you sleep? Do all your patterns go all...
Well, years of unemployment trained me well. I was all right, but...
what does that mean? You just sleep when you sleep?
Well, because I just, you know, like, I mean, I was... I've probably been on the dole as much as I've worked, you know.
But you be... Don't say like that, because you've been working when you've been on the dole. You just haven't had a job.
Yeah. But, like, but what job, I mean, though, is that I was, like, going to bed at daylight and sleeping all day or whatever, you know, because... Yeah. You know, I mean, I personally write better at night, and sometimes you get inspired, and then next thing the sun's coming up. So it was okay for me, but I think some of the other artists went crazy. One woman went home early. One person put tinfoil over the windows.
Someone went home early?
Yeah, she couldn't handle it.
Yeah, right.
But I didn't give a fuck. And I was drinking a lot at that point, so just drink till you fall asleep and wake up and do something else. You know?
Halcyon days. By the way, wee story about my connection to you and your work. And since I've seen you then, because you've seen me at a few shows, you've always kind of bumped each other on the street. I'm just a kind of, you know, dude in the crowd. Always had good chats and stuff. But I came back to Auckland. I came back to New Zealand like probably 2007. And I'd been in Melbourne 6 or 7 years. And the last bit of that was not great for me. So basically I was back in New Zealand like, not in a good headspace at all, outside the scope of us chatting for the next few minutes. But, you know, we have these moments in life, right? And so I don't know. So the point of that is I don't know whether it was me and my headspace or what was kind of going on creatively at the time around, but I just couldn't really find anything here inspiring that I was seeing and hearing and stuff. And then Sam Wicks took me out to a show of yours, I think at Whammy, around then 2007, 2008. And I was just blown away, man. I was like, you know, it was spoken word. You did some poetry and so on. It was just an amazing show. And it was you. And then about a year or two later, when I heard Benefit, which is kind of almost their novelty tune, that Tom Scott was the next person that I kind of lit my creative fires here again in Auckland.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd put that in to say cheers, bro. You know, that was I've followed you shamelessly since. But my point with that is it's actually been a while since I've been to a show. So I think the last one I went to was you with Sam Hunt.
Okay, yeah.
Who's another person I really, you know, a lot of Kiwis look to for obvious reasons. How was that, man? Like, you've been a poet all your life, and you're kind of with the New Zealand Don Dutta. Was it humbling or educational or just another show? Or
So we did. What happened was we did two shows together, and they both sold out. And the first one, I didn't really take it that seriously.
I went to the Golden Dawn one.
Yeah, so there was the two at Golden Dawn.
Yeah.
And I don't know which one you're at, but the first one, I didn't really take that seriously. Yeah. And so, I mean, I always practice a lot, but not, you know, I just didn't really take it that seriously. And he just eclipsed me, like blew me away.
What do you mean? Like, what's so that in poetry terms?
He was just so much better than me. And so the next time I was like, fuck this. And I just practiced and I wrote and I just, and I feel like, and there's a review of it that said like I held my own with him. And that's not to say that I'm, you know, he's Sam Hunt. He's been doing it so much longer than me. But I just really was like, yeah. So like you say, it just really inspired me. It really lit a fire under me because I was just like, because, you know, like, I think in the rap world, I was an amazing poet. But then you go into the poetry world and you're just another fucking dude doing it. And that was that performing with him was the first time. Because that was probably the... Cause that was,
it kind of validated you. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you felt it.
Well, because, you know, like, poetry was always the side thing and rapping was the main thing. And around that time that we did the first gig with him was when I was just starting to make poetry the main thing.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the kick up the ass. And I was lucky that happened, because otherwise, you know, you're like, oh, I'm fucking amazing.
Who booked you? Who said, oh, we'll put you with...
Matthew Crawley.
Was Crawley, yeah.
And then the second one, Sam asked for it. Yeah. But then I think he got a bit salty about the interview.
What do you mean?
Not the interview, sorry, the review.
Oh!
Because it had a big picture of me, and it said he was passing the baton, and then I saw Mitch Spool, and he's like, if I pass you the baton, I'll let you know. And I was like, man, I didn't say it, like, you know. And I, like, I mean, like I say, like, had that, like, I took so much from him. Because what I really took from him is not only, like, obviously he's an amazing poet, he's an amazing performer, but just how sometimes he wouldn't do a poem for 5 minutes and just talk to the crowd and just, you know, like, use his charm.
So that idea, because you've got that in bucket loads too, man. So I guess that idea of, yeah, you're right, because when I saw you back in the day, it was like, but you've always had great, that's part of the appeal of seeing you, are those great little kind of cheeky quips between each, but you mean sort of extending out that.
Yeah.
More of a show.
Yeah.
A show with yeah.
Well, I mean, he's a master, so any time that you're around someone of that level, you're going to get better. It's the same with Tosiata Avia, do you know her, the poet? So she's incredible, and when I've performed with her, you're just like, okay, there's another level to this. And it's just so good being shown those levels, you know, because otherwise I think it is very easy to just, you know, when everyone's like giving you high fives and like, you're the man, and then you're like, yes, I am, and it's good to be humbled, you know?
Yeah. It's good you did a, yeah, that's right, you did a stadium show.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that too, like, that's terrible. I haven't heard of another, obviously, renowned New Zealand poet. I mean, how many of you are there? Like, that might be a... Yeah, you know what I'm getting at. Like how many people are kind of actively full-time poets in New Zealand? It's not a hugely populous art form compared to even rapping.
There's a lot of poets, but I don't know how many there are. I mean, because there's different communities. So there's a slam community, which, you know, I feel like obviously has its... Some parts of it are really good, but I think other parts are kind of limited in scope. There's the kind of drunken bohemian thing where I think it's very difficult for people to step out of that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really talented...
It's because they've got alcohol problems.
Yeah, and just because I think, like, I don't know, they seem to be, and I'm not trying to be an asshole here because I really respect a lot of those people, but I think that there's kind of like... There's almost a shame around being professional.
Yeah.
Whereas I think because...
Well, you get a lot of that in the music industry and so on as well.
Yeah. Whereas I think... Like,
sell out!
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously just poets, and I think I'm sort of somewhere in the middle. But I definitely take influence from both. I mean, Shane Hollins was a big influence when I met him at a party when I was like 18.
Yeah.
And he did a poem that went about snowboarding, and I was like, oh shit, like... You know?
You got any funny stories about... I got this...
He's someone you should get on the podcast.
Who's that?
Shane Hollins.
Okay,
do you know him?
No, when I go back, I actually need... I need more guests outside of my circles. I need more ladies as well. That's a tough thing in... It's not that there isn't enough talented ladies around. It's just... it's a weird... It's like the podcast thing I notice with a lot of these long-form podcasts I listen to from around the world, there is a real gender imbalance. Like,
well, you know what it is?
A lot of the stand-up comedian dudes, it's all dudes, you know?
Well, I mean, some of that's just because they're sexist, but another part...
No, I don't know, man. Someone like Maron's not sexist.
No, he's not. Yeah, but yeah, I mean... But anyway, but like what we found was with the How Not To Be An Arsehole one is like...
I think I'm sexist.
I'm not saying that, but what we found was that you have to actually try to be diverse because obviously, like... I mean, we initially had a bunch of women, and then we had, you know, like, you know, we had people of all different sexualities and ethnic backgrounds, whatever. But then sometimes you'd just be like, oh, shit, we just had 5 white guests in a row, or we just had 5 dudes in a row.
Yeah.
And you just had to be quite conscious of it.
Yeah. This is white guys in their 40s at the moment, mostly. But I have been self-referential about it. I've joked about it.
If you make a conscious effort, like if you just say, this is... something I'm going to do, then you'll be able to do it.
Yeah.
Even just say that. I mean, put a post.
Did you ever hear that one, Lani? Yeah, well, did you ever hear that podcast Lani Says?
Yeah, well,
I emailed her. I didn't hear back. I should probably chase it up. But hers just stopped. That's a real shame. I wanted to have her in here.
Yeah, but no, we had her on the How Not To Be An Arsehole.
Yeah.
She was she's a good guest.
Yeah, she had some great guests on hers, eh? It's interesting. It's...
But I think the other thing was that's one of the reasons why we stopped, because I think to get a lot of people that are maybe more on the fringes, like, so we really wanted to get some of those No Pride in Prison people, we wanted to get the Prostitutes Collective, but those people, like, it's hard to get their trust, and especially when you're a bunch of white dudes doing a podcast called How Not to Be an Asshole, and you all look like fucking the way
well,
we look.
I mean, my dad's, to be quite frank, from the underworld and always has been, you know, he's a long-term criminal, so on and so forth, and I had a friend of his pop back into my life recently, and some of the stories he told me, I was like, man, this would be a, you know, I was like, can we turn the mics on, but, you know, the stories are going to stop as soon as that happened. You're right. So there's like, you know, that's that thing, it's like, to actually get someone to mediate that stuff's different. It's, it's all right for us that we kind of do that on and off all the time. To the podcast thing, because I joke with you and you're like, yeah, I'm the same, like how I've gone from like pretty much a all music diet to just like, when I was a kid, I'd be like, I'd see an older man like with his transistor radio on all the time, just with national radio. I'd be like, man, that's so dull. I'm never going to do that. But I just listen to talk all the time now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's mainly podcasts and stuff. So with that, and I'm guessing you'll be into stand-up as well. What are some podcasts that you dig? And are you into stand-up comedy? And what stand-up comedians do you really like?
Yeah, I really like stand-up. I mean, I don't really like a lot because I find that most of them are just kind of... especially American ones, like I watched that new Dave Chappelle and that new Louis C.K.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear your thoughts on those. They seem quite dystopian compared to some of their older
work. I feel like they're, obviously they're both incredibly talented, but it's like Dave Chappelle like seemed like to be more conservative and all that sort of weird, like, you know, like sort of when he's talking about gay people or whatever and just kind of like, can never just say like, we're on the same fucking page, you know, like it's always got to be like that sort of us and them kind of thing.
I thought about that when I watched that. I don't think he was being disrespectful to transgenders. I think he was speaking to overly politically correct people, maybe.
But he's been clumsy.
Did you watch both of the Chappelle ones? Because they were real different, hey?
The second one sucked. The first one was, I thought, was good.
Well, there was one that was commissioned that was very much Netflix's
big
event.
The more recent one I thought was good. The one
is that the one where he does
in Hollywood?
The one where he does the obvious Netflix promo as part of the $20 million deal.
I'm not sure.
He goes at the beginning. He goes, oh, so I've been watching blah 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 on Netflix, and I'm like, this is a Netflix special.
Not the one he sits down. When he sits down, I felt that it was really weak. He sits down and smokes a cigarette in it.
Yeah, I have to go back. I think that's the second one, is it?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But oh look, man. I mean, he's obviously a genius, but I just think it's like, I felt like when he first came out, maybe this was me projecting on him. I felt like he was quite progressive, and I felt like he had kind of interesting politics. And then this one, it just kind of felt like, it kind of felt like the same stance that like Eddie Murphy had, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean.
And it's like, and I just sort of thought, oh, that's a shame, because I think like, I mean, he's the same age as us, you know? And so there's no reason why he needs to be left behind.
No.
Politically.
Yeah. But then it's funny you say that with the Eddie Murphy thing, because I mentioned the money thing, like, and I'm not saying he's gone as far as kind of fat suits and Dr. Doolittle and that kind of thing, but you know, that's a cool $20 million he just made. So maybe it is very easy to get sucked into that. I mean, that's a lot of.
But I don't think he's. I mean, I'm sure he had creative control.
Yeah.
You know, like you're not.
Well, he gave two Netflix shout outs.
Yeah, but you're not going to sign Dave Chappelle and be like, now you have to do this. After he walked away.
You have to do two Netflix shout outs.
Yeah, but whatever. I mean, like, I don't think that. He walked away from $40 million on his show, so I can't believe that he's going to.
No, that's right, yeah.
You know, and I mean, he'd make enough money to fucking live very comfortably just from his show fees, let alone.
Yeah, so I think summing up what you said, that, yeah, you think he's lost that kind of, a bit more kind of acerbic, observational,
but maybe
political thing, and he's going a bit more.
The stupid,
which
there's always stupid sex jokes, and it's just kind of like, I mean, it's just. It's just boring, you know? Yeah. You know who I really like is Stuart.
And that's what I asked you, is who you like. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like Stuart Lee.
Yep.
I find him, he's super inspiring. Who else was
who it? Do you like for their kind of, their pace and their feel as someone who obviously is someone about how the words kind of pop off and how you deliver them?
Yeah, he's someone, for sure. And then I was listening to this woman.
Sorry, I kind of put you on the spot.
That's okay. I try to remember her name, a Scottish woman. Oh, she's quite young. She's really funny.
Young Scottish woman. I'm sure we can find that with the Google.
I listened to a podcast called Comedian's Comedian.
Yeah.
And then I
just
go through that, and
I'll remember that when I listen.
To the interview, and if I like the interview, then I'll go listen to their stand up. And it's really interesting, though, how often sometimes there's like when they talk about their stand up, it's like, wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah,
and I learn things from it. But
that's what I love
about
them.
You watch the stand up though, and it's not even that good, and you're just like,
well, that's happened a few times.
What's that
guy? Rogan, who a lot of people just don't like because he's too much of a bro. I actually quite like a lot of his podcasts. He can be a douche, but you know, hey, it's raw conversation. But yeah, his comedy, dude, is just, it's frat boy.
What's weird, because like him and all his mates, like they talk about like they're the best comedians ever.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't know.
He's like, yeah.
Who's that guy, that Canadian comedian?
Oh, there's so many.
Name?
Dana Carvey.
No.
Hey, this is compelling listening.
Yeah, sorry.
So I was just thinking about, you know, I like podcast stand-up wise. There's a British guy called Adam Carr who I stumbled across because he did one with Louis Theroux. That's a fun listen. But yeah, comedy. What is it? Comedy's comedy. I'll check
comedians,
it out. Comedian's comedy. I had a good old friend in here, Fergus, who's a mime. He's been a mime in Wellington for, I mean, I saw him performing when I was a kid, kind of a thing. We got to know each other later on. And he sort of talked about a couple of times, you know, early on, the dilemma of telling people that you're going to be a mime. And he actually said that his guidance counselor at school said, what, you're going to be a minor? A minor? He said, no, I'm going to be a mime. Have you come up against that kind of, you're a what, you know, early on when you wanted to be a poet?
Oh, well, more so, I mean, I guess when I was a rapper, you know.
I'm talking about shitty prejudice.
Oh, totally, man. Like, I remember, like, people would start going, you're a rapper, yo, yo, and, like, waving their hands around, and I was like, I have friends that would punch you for that, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I was just, that was, but I mean, because I think it's hard, I guess, for young, if there's any younger people listening to this, but it'd be hard to imagine a time when hip-hop, you know, like, hip-hop is the biggest music in the world now, but it wasn't always like that, and I think the idea that you were going to be a rapper was like, especially in the like late 90s, early
2000s.
Being white, was a crazy thing. And it was weird to me because we'd always just grown up rapping, like me and all my mates, and we just rapped about, you know, just, well, we were terrible, but we'd just rap about our days, and we rap about going to school, and rap about whatever. And it just was a thing that everyone did, and then it never occurred to me that this was something you couldn't do until, you know, you sort of hit that prejudice. But by that point I was like, oh fuck, I don't care, you know, this is my thing. Like, growing up, it was never like, I remember telling my dad I wanted to be a writer, and then he was just like, read books. And then which was really amazing advice, but apart from that, it was just kind of,
has
like,
he come to your shows as a rapper or poet?
Not really, like, because he's been out of the country a lot. He's been to a couple. My mum's been to a few.
And then with that, because the reason I thought about that was not only the chat I had with Fergus, but another thing I watched, cramming to talk to you today, was that quite funny poem about going to Wins, or that tune about going to Wins. The whole fuck work thing with the tattoo that you've got that she sees in that video, did that come from that project you did? You did a project where you had stuff from the book tattooed on you as you read the book. Is that where that comes from?
No, that's just a stupid tattoo I got. I wanted to get it on my hands when I was young, but then luckily someone stopped me.
That's a weird regret thing. You talked about the Tourette's one on your chest as well. Are you really sort of you've backpedaled on some of your tats?
Oh, I mean, you know, like
do good cover ups these days?
Yeah, I'm getting stuff. I mean, I don't really give a fuck about tattoos anymore, though. Like, because I guess it was just something that we did to be like, you know, we're not part of this society. And then society's like, nah, we, you know, yes, you are. Come back here.
You mean, and everyone else getting them?
Yeah, like you see cops with full sleeve and shit now.
Yeah. Well, like back to my old man, the different world to you. That's right. I grew up with a whole lot of blue people around me, but
it
was jail. Jail blue, so that's probably why I've kind of refrained on that thing. So to that show, you were releasing the book and you had a live tattooing session. Was that a few years ago? How many words did you get up?
That was recently. So what initially the idea was to get the whole book tattooed on me, But then we kind of realized it would take fucking forever.
Ran out of space?
Yeah, so then, but what happened was Josh Solomon, who did the illustrations in my book, or our book, because we mutually did it, he tattooed one of the drawings from the book on me while I read the book in a window for Art Week last year.
Yeah.
It was really cool. We're actually going to, I think we're going to do something similar for the novel.
Where are they?
It's just on my leg.
How many words?
It's just a picture.
A picture.
And it says, Josh loves Dom.
Oh, that's lovely. Another thing that you've chatted about recently, obviously because it's a fucking hassle, understandably, is your kind of health and so on. How's that? How's that, man? Are you, are you in better shape than you were a few years ago?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now. Like, not dead, but I wouldn't physically be able to come and do this unless someone drove me here. Like, because I couldn't really walk. And even going in a car was so painful that I kind of avoided it, you know?
Well, have you talked enough, have you talked too much about this to want to talk about it again?
When
did it sort of all, you just got out of bed one day how many years ago and were like, fuck, what's going on?
Well, I mean, in retrospect, I probably had, so what I have is a disease called ankylosing spondylitis, which is a...
I thought I'd let you do that.
Yeah, I know, it took me about 3 months to learn how to say it, but it's basically a form of arthritis. It's an autoimmune disease, can affect your organs, fucks with your memory. But I've had chest pains my whole life, and I've gone to the doctor, and it's like, my chest hurts, and they've tested my heart and everything, and they said, there's nothing wrong with you. But in retrospect, that's what it was. But it didn't really get bad until about 2011. It started getting quite bad. And then by the end of 2012, I couldn't walk, really. And so I was in, and I lost all this weight, like it was like a skeleton. And I was in Melbourne, I had to come home and just convalesce, basically, in my mate's bedroom.
Yeah,
my mate, he owns a house and he has a spare room. And
so, what are we dealing with here? Like the way you talk about it, is it like something you were born with, or is it genetic?
Genetic, but it's like turned on by something. But they don't know. I mean, it could have been drugs, it could have been trauma, it could have been malnutrition when I was young.
But
like,
you have anyone else in your family have it? Have you been able to trace it back?
Not really. Or, I mean, potentially maybe my dad has it because he's quite stiff, but it's not like he's not as bad as me.
Yeah,
but it can just come on as well.
And so then did you go, because I'd imagine it's, you know, it's not a common name, it's not a commonly known condition. Did you go through a long period of frustration of trying to be diagnosed, maybe coupled with people?
Yeah, it's about 6 months or maybe a year. I can't remember how long.
How many specialists and doctors did you get through?
Well, I was very poor, so I only went to the same fucking shitty doctor in Tauranga.
Yeah, it's good that he spotted it, man. Like a shitty GP, you might not.
Well, no, what happened was I went in there and she was, I actually got a poem about this, but I went in there and she goes, couldn't really walk. Every time, if I sat down, took me about 5 minutes to get back up again, and she's like, you're not sick enough to go on a sickness benefit. I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, come on. And then I eventually talked to her into it. She wouldn't give me...
So it sounds like she thought you were trying to scam.
Yeah, she wouldn't give me any painkillers. So I had to buy morphine illegally. And then, you know what I mean? And then she got x-rays done, and he said, oh, look, there's nothing in the x-rays, basically insinuating that I'm faking it. And then, about 3 months later, I don't know what happened. She must have sent it to a specialist because she rings up and goes, actually, you're really sick. You got to go to the rheumatologist. And
any tone of apology in her voice? Or
no. And I was like, I don't even know what a rheumatologist was. I was like, is that to do with feet? Like, and so then I go there and the dude's like, yeah, mate, look, you're really fucking sick. It's going to take a few years off your life. You might have a heart condition. Here's a pamphlet. I'll see you in a year. And he's just like, what the fuck?
So, and you're like suddenly standing outside in the cold with your pamphlet. Like,
yeah. And my girlfriend at the time was like, so what's up? And I was like, I have anger. I have this thing. I don't know how to say it, but this is what I got.
And he said it might take 2 or 3 years off my life. He said to call back next week.
So then I just started researching it and finding out a lot. And I think that's, been really proactive. And
so what's the upshot, man? Is it a lifetime of kind of taking meds every day, or is there things you can do to arrest it? Or
Yeah, I've changed my life a lot. I mean, I don't really drink anymore. I don't really do drugs anymore, apart from smoking weed. And I take lots of turmeric and holistic medicines, do yoga, do a lot of calisthenics, so a lot of push-ups and sit-ups and stuff.
So again, not something you'd kind of go, hey, we'll have this come along because it's going to make me change things, but it's kind of, maybe it's good that
I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. I wouldn't have met my partner, who is amazing. I wouldn't have just everything that's happening now, I know happened because of that, because I probably would have just kept on trying to rap and just kept on taking drugs. Not that I was taking a lot of drugs, but you know what I mean? Just that lifestyle.
Yeah, you're taking enough drugs to make it worth mentioning taking drugs.
Yeah, just that lifestyle, which is, you know, still appealing occasionally when you, you know, going to...
When the right act comes to town.
Yeah, and you know, you go to a bar and you know everyone there and everyone's having a drink and then why don't we do a line and then suddenly it's 4 a.m. and it's like... you know, and there's a camaraderie in that, and you know what I mean? And I think that that's...
Absolutely, yeah.
And there's a ritual to it.
And there's something there, that's right. I know what you're saying, and there's something you would mourn because that's been a part of your life if it just completely disappeared.
Yeah.
I hear that.
And because it's based around creativity, it wasn't like, you know, like I know a lot of people that do drugs and they're just sitting in a fucking room with the curtains closed. Just, you know, whereas we were playing shows and we were traveling and we were...
You're preaching to the choir, man. Yeah. It's all good. Yeah,
I'm more just for your listeners. Yeah, I think I'm some kind of fucking meth addict or something.
So, look, and then so I play devil's advocate with myself again. You know, it's, you know, welcome change in your life. But at the same time, you know, are you still dealing with a lot of kind of frustrating stuff like pain that you didn't have before? And
oh, yeah, I'm always in pain. But, I mean, I feel like I'm...
Oh, dude, that's pretty full on. I'm always in pain.
I don't know, I just feel quite accepting of it now. Yeah. The main thing I really miss is running. I used to run a lot, and I can't run anymore.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing that really bums me out. And then, obviously, it's hard. I think my partner finds it quite hard because ultimately, most probably, the drugs will kill me.
The drugs you're taking to arrest it.
Yeah, so it's sort of like having to... And, you know, that might not happen for 20 or 30 years, but... I guess just sort of having that, and because I think she finds it so depressing to read about it, she probably thinks it's worse than it is. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Whereas I'm like, just read this thing, and she's like, I
got this other pamphlet. You know, okay. Won't dwell on this too much longer, but you know, shit. I've had a relative go through the health system with similar stories that you paraphrased with the care of the doctor and the specialist. Same thing, partners researched a lot of it and da 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 da, but that's actually not the point I was going to. The point I was going to, just to round it off, is how many of you are there in New Zealand? Is it like something that's, you're one in 1,000 or?
I think more. Like, I think there was 6 million in the world.
Wow.
But
so
I actually know quite a few people.
That's boutique, bro.
I wonder if it's because I talk about it that people. But yeah, like.
Well, you did say that you get emails from people with Tourette's, so.
Yeah, but I mean, I actually have this. I don't have Tourette's, but weirdly, one of my best friends has it, and then like another good friend just got diagnosed, and then.
Hang on a second. What was in the walls at your primary school? You know, is there something?
I think it might be a lot of it. Potentially, I don't know about these guys how they grew up, but I think a lot of it could be to do with like bad nutrition.
Yeah. You spoke about that a few times. Do you mean that just like in your late teens and early 20s, you just didn't? You just didn't eat.
Even before that, like, I mean, you know, like we usually had pretty healthy dinners, but then, you know, we just have sandwiches and Weet-Bix and just, you know, people didn't understand nutrition the way they do now.
Yeah,
you know?
It's interesting. And then a series of those flats you wrote about in the spin-off, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that didn't help, I'm sure.
And so how does it change? This is a stock question, but I think it's really worthy of asking. Last thing on that is, how's it kind of changed your perspective on everything, man?
It makes you think about death a lot.
Yeah.
And kind of, I guess, accepting that. It's made me grow up a lot, I think. Because being an artist, it's very easy just to sort of be, whether it's self-destructive or narcissistic or all those things, but saying, well, I'm doing art, so it's okay. Whereas I think that sort of makes that, I don't know, just shows that for what it is.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's mostly been positive, you know.
It's a speaking of positivity, you're it's a curious combo. It's a great combo of just your persona and your kind of vibe, and then your kind of critique, I guess, of systems and so on around you. And are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I think I'm an optimist.
Yeah, I would have guessed that.
I think. You know, like, I really believe that human beings are essentially, you know, good, empathetic creatures. And I think that, you know, it's like capitalism reinforces the worst parts of our personalities, and but still, we, you know, generally most people will help you if you need help. And you know, I found that so much with my condition.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I fucking came back, I couldn't work, you know, people were bringing me food, coming and visiting me, my mate gave me a room to live in, like, just stuff like that. Like
when the chips are down.
Yeah
And then what about with the city, bro? Like, we're talking earlier, like, you were talking about the changing of Greyland, the divide in Auckland now and stuff. You're still here. Are you a pessimist or optimist about Auckland and about New Zealand?
Oh, no, man. I feel like we're in a really bad trajectory.
New Zealand, Auckland?
Both.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it can be turned around, you know? Like, I feel like if we keep going the way we're going, I can't even imagine how fucking awful it's going to be in 20 years. Just, you know, if the water, you know, just the roads and you know, like, just no forward thinking, and just the sort of lack of I don't know, there's so much potential here in New Zealand. And I think when you go somewhere like Iceland, which is kind of similar, smaller population, but and they've embraced who they are so much and have, you know, and they're just such an amazing society. And whereas, you know, New Zealand, it's sort of like, what is there really here to be proud of, you know? In saying that, in the mainstream of society, obviously in the fringes,
Things, but go on. I've been nodding the whole time. It's a funny one. I mean, what is that? We've already spoken to the obvious things like power and the dollar and capitalism and so on, but is it like, to me in Auckland, let's just stick with Auckland for a bit, there's like, there seems to be something wrong with planning. Like, we've got all these people coming on in, potential for this amazing, diverse, vibrant city, which we have population-wise and so on, but I don't know if it's bureaucracy or whatever, things aren't moving or adapting fast enough. It seems like we kind of hold on to this old New Zealand. I'm thinking both kind of infrastructure and, what do you call it, like culture and stuff-wise. Do you sort of get what I'm getting at? Like, it's a sort of weird mix of progress on the ground or whatever sometimes, but things not moving like they do in other cities. Like, I live in Melbourne. You know when you first moved to Melbourne?
Yeah.
And even just getting around and stuff, you're like, what's going on back home, you know?
But there's no reason, I think, why some of the positive parts of gentrification couldn't happen to a community without destroying it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So why you couldn't have, you know, like, good infrastructure, why you couldn't have places to eat which aren't just like fast food and stuff come along, and all those things, you know, whilst not forcing out the inhabitants of that community. But, you know, it's just the housing thing is just insane. Like, you know, we got given notice on our house, and it's like, what the fuck are we going to do? Because I don't want to live in New Lynn, like, and I don't want to live in Albany, so it's sort of like, well, where can I afford to live? And
when you first got in here, you know, you're like, how long you been here? And I'm like, well, I'm so comfortable here. This is the longest I've been anywhere since I left home. Left home sometime in the 90s. And when you said, ours is the same, and we've got to go, I'm like, fuck having to do that right now. You know?
Could just imagine that it's probably going to be like this for the rest of my life, potentially.
Yeah. Well, places like England are just, you know, that whole, what do you call it, the aristocracy? I don't know what you call it, but that ruling class that have always owned everything.
Yeah.
Maybe we just do fall into that mentality of, I'm going to rent all my life. And
which would be fine if we had renters' rights, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like how they haven't.
What are they, bro? How does that work in the UK compared to here? I don't really know.
I'm not sure about the UK, but I know.
Well, yeah, in general.
Berlin, it's like the renter has as much right as the owner.
Yeah.
And they can't just kick you out.
Yeah.
And, like, people stay in flats for, like, 20, 30 years, raise their kids in there, knock down walls, paint them, sublet them out to other people.
I hear you. Whereas here it's more like a...
And there's rent caps. You can't charge past a certain amount.
So how's the looking going, bro? What's on the market?
I haven't actually looked yet. I've been to, like, it's like, oh, fuck.
Is it just going
to
be you and your girlfriend?
I'm not sure. We're trying to decide what to do. But
You know, another thing you said that spoke to me... because, again, when I joked about when my serotonin's down and I think about travel and so on, somewhere I read today you were like, oh, most of my friends are overseas. So why, I mean, have you thought about moving overseas permanently or?
Well, before I got sick, I was thinking about moving to Berlin.
Yeah.
But now with my condition, it just makes it too much of a headache.
Okay. Yeah. I flip this around, you know. I've had some great days in Auckland and getting out and around. I don't want this to be doomy gloomy. I don't want to get like some stigma on me in this podcast about being down on where I live. But, I mean, New Zealand does have some great things, right?
Oh, I think like the talent in this country, and especially in Auckland, is insane. Like I didn't realize that too. I went traveling. Like I just thought there was this many talented people everywhere. But it's crazy. Like you know, I just a lot of my favorite artists in whatever discipline are from this country.
We've got another 10 minutes. What's happening with? So you've got. Just talk a little bit about the book launch. And what's happening with that on the ground, just in terms of people who want to... are you doing something public along with it, or is it just the book's going to hit the shelves? Like, what's the process from here on in? Now you've got a publisher is probably the best thing to ask.
So I guess we're just getting all the press ready at the moment,
yeah.
And then we're going to start getting all the press copies out and doing all that, interviews and stuff, and then we're going to do a launch, I think on K Road somewhere. So we're going to do a big launch, and then later in the year I'm going to do a big tour of New Zealand and sort of bring the book with me. And
read from the book as well as do poems?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
But I'm not sure. I mean, it depends how much it gets picked up. I mean, obviously if it gets this sort of momentum, who knows what's going to happen, you know?
Oh, this is the beauty of a podcast, completely non-sequential. I just realised what I wanted to ask at the tail end of the... critiquing Auckland and New Zealand thing. Have you seen that latest Adam Curtis doco, Hypernormalisation? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
That whole democracy is broken thing fascinated me, man. Because how do I relate that to what you were talking about? So just someone else's perspective on if all this stuff's going on and you know, a number of the things we've spoken to in this podcast, like how do you change... Asking you, putting this all on your shoulders, how do we change this decades, you know, old system? And I probably don't just mean democracy. I mean the whole New Zealand's a, what do you call it, a capitalist democracy now. Do you think that people can break that or change that?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, like short term, I think what we need to do is people need to take responsibility for their actions. I see so many, and I'm not, you know, I've been guilty of this before, but I just think, like, it's much more important to do something than to say it, you know what I mean? And that sounds really fucking obvious, but I think...
Which he says in the doco, and is a very strong narrative.
But, yeah, you know, like, it's so easy, I think, like, I see people on Twitter, on both the left and the right, attacking people for what they're doing, but then they don't do anything, you know what I mean? And I think, like, so I think strengthening communities... I think looking out for one another. I think not taking the money, you know, like, you know, so when fucking Nike or Burger King or whatever come knocking and they want to co-opt your art or whatever, you say no, like, I don't, you know, like...
Because you've been offered a cola check, right? Or something similar.
We got offered a Coca-Cola tour. Yeah. I was actually just thinking about that today. And then also we got offered to write a rap for Burger King. So all up, I mean, it would have been tens of thousands of dollars and... You know, it wasn't hard for me to turn down. I think my rap partner at the time was a bit bummed, you know what I mean? Because we were broke. I mean, we were basically...
Good on you, though.
But no, but I think... But the thing is, like, obviously, if someone came along for $1 million, then you got to be okay. But, like, if someone's offering you the amount of money, which... The way I thought about it was, if in 5 years, is this going to be... Has this going to have changed my life? No. Is it going to have impeded my creativity? Yes. So it's not worth it, you know?
It's nice to know you have a price.
What's that?
It's nice to know you have a price.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Can come on, $1 million?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's like...
I hear you, no, yeah.
But I know, like, fuck, who was it? Someone, some activist was talking about, you know, sometimes you do get enough money where you can actually change your world with that money, you know?
Yes.
Not that world, but your world. Then it's kind of like... Then it becomes selfish not to take their money and not to put it back into your community.
Yeah, for sure. But back to what we were speaking to, do you think that, because I heard this in another podcast as well as thinking about it with Hypernormalisation, I had this week where I watched and listened to these three completely different people talk overall about completely different things, but they all linked up in terms of their critique of the democratic system.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the actual system where it's at now is could almost be completely toppled over and changed into something else?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like, I can't remember who said it, but it's like, you know, like, change seems impossible until it happens and then it seems inevitable. I'm paraphrasing there. But, you know, like, I think that it's just whether things change for the better or not, you know, is the issue. But, yeah, I mean, things are definitely going to change. I mean, if you see, like, how much everything's falling to pieces and the holes in the system. I mean, even since the GFC, how people talk about the capitalist system in the mainstream media now, they never did that. They never admitted that it was a system. It was just the way things are.
Yeah, you know? So I
think that in itself, and even like, I don't like the term identity politics because I feel like it's sort of like used by the right, and same with political correctness, it's used to sort of undermine basically fighting for basic human rights for people, fighting for dignity. But I think that a lot of those politics are things that you know, in the 90s were on the fringes of society, which you read about in little photocopied zines and you talked about at punk shows of anarchists, are now in the mainstream.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
As much as, obviously, you know, there's dickheads that misuse it on both sides of the political spectrum, but that's always going to be the case too, you know?
Yeah, and I think saying things will topple, and it'll be interesting, like, you know, back to that human nature thing, and perhaps the 1% not being a financial thing, but that kind of, you know, fundamentally bad people thing we talked about much earlier on, is like, if and when it topples, what happens next will be a real interesting and potentially terrifying or very good test of human nature and our ability to get together and form something else without absolute kind of chaos ensuing, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean,
we've been ruled so long.
Yeah, well, I'm not necessarily a Marxist, but I do sort of lean towards some of his philosophies. But I think that, you know, he was saying that it's really important to have like an educated to educate the proletarian or educate the masses or poor people, because when that time comes, you need them to have an understanding of the system, you know what I mean? Because otherwise you're going to end up with things like people voting for Trump or people voting, I don't know, Brexit is a bit more complicated, but, you know, like people just basically voting against their interests and not understanding that they're doing that.
Because they've been marketed to vote against their interests,
and
essentially.
And it's because they've just been, they've just been abandoned by the system. And you know, and it's very easy to sort of, when you have nothing, to sort of to fall into hate, you know, because you're like, well, fuck these people.
Did Adam Curtis refer to leaders now as cartoon villains or something, didn't he?
I'm not sure.
Did you notice, like, I noticed just a few minutes ago, I noticed, I just thought of the futility of all the people I saw on Facebook kind of, John Key's a dick, da-da-da-da-da, that sort of thing. The cartoon villain and that, like you say, that bunch of people kind of yelling into binary.
Mm.
On the internet, nothing happens afterwards.
But
there's nothing
wrong with that as long as it's coupled with action. That's what I mean. Like, you know, like, I think it's...
No, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Venting is important, and I think it's good to have your community of like-minded people, but then you need to take it to the streets, or you need to do petitions, or you need to go and support people that are affected negatively by these policies, you know?
It was odd seeing you on the cafe. You came, it was great. I just watched some footage today. I was like, is that the cafe?
Yeah. They just hit me up and it was cool.
It's good, man. Yeah, more exposure. Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure. And like I say, I've sort of been a fan since I came back to Auckland. It was inspiring to be inspired by someone.
Well, thanks, man.
At that point. If I find a piece of your work to put on the end of this podcast, what have you got, a particular piece of spoken word or something that
just whatever, like whatever you feel is, maybe the new New Zealand.
Cool. Okay, I'll do that. Good luck with the book launch, and thanks for coming on in, man.
Thank you. Dawn.
cabled hen's night. Suburban children window shop for memories at half price. Roaches limping down the footpath, the trash on the street is restless. I'm in a cafe with the newspaper screaming at me over breakfast. Photos of private parties plastered across its pages. The privileged get publicity for getting pissed, aren't they amazing? Meanwhile, in the editorial, the unemployed get vilified and labeled lazy. The rich can be eccentric, while the poor are merely crazy. The real estate section's filled with mold-covered bedrooms for $250 each. Burning borrowed money every night so that we don't freeze. We never hear from the landlord long as the rent's in every week. I know that arsehole's dreams, I just wonder how he sleeps. Back on the street with the coffee in my veins. Cash rules everything around me, that's why the bus is always late. And all the graffiti is commissioned and the fights are worth winning. No one cares about your life, just what you do for a living. And I can't hide forever beneath St. Kevin's arcade. That asshole from Shoreland Street wants to level the place. Reckons he'll fix it up, but I suspect he has terrible taste. And all his money can't make up for his annoying face.
And all the paint we spill, and all the shows we play for free. All of this was for you. All the shitty day jobs he worked that no one else would do. So we could follow our dreams at night like you told us to. All the songs we wrote, and all the paint we spilled, all the shows we played for free, all of this was for you. All the shitty day jobs we worked that no one else would do, so we could follow our dreams at night like you told us to.
No millions at the food court, no politicians on the street. No socialize at the park, money makes everything cheap. No journalists at the protest, no businessmen on the bus. No entrepreneurs at the wins, there's only us. Standing at the station waiting for the new electric train to take me back home, but they're always heading the other way. The new neighbors love the city, but it's lights out at 10. Now you can hear their televisions over the band. There's another apartment block every time I look up from my phone. And when the traffic dies, you can hear the city moan. And all I'm trying to do is buy some food and write some poems. And after each election, I feel a little more alone. The shopkeepers hose away the weekend every Monday, along with all those awful people sleeping in the doorways. Cause they don't fit into the new New Zealand and never will. We change the flag to a middle finger on a $100 bill. And happily herald the heroes of Husking and Henry. Harbingers of hatred have never looked so friendly. Those bougie baby boomers blaming every little problem on millennials like a 25-year-old invented Rogernomics. And everything's sticky with their advertising magic. But not everyone's a fan of Bilbo Baggins or Peter Jackson. I hate the fucking All Blacks more than you can imagine. And the Air New Zealand safety videos make me wish the plane was crashing.
All the songs we wrote, and all the paint we spilled, and all the shows we played for free, all of this was for you. All the shitty day jobs he worked that no one else would do, so we could follow our dreams at night like you told us to. All the songs we wrote, and all the paint we spilled, all the shows we played for free, all of this was for you. All the shitty day jobs he worked that no one else would do, so we could follow our dreams at night like you told us to.
No millionaires at the food court, no politicians on the street. No socialize at the park, money makes everything cheap. No journalists at the protest, no businessmen on the bus. No entrepreneurs at the wins, there's only us. So kill the fucker, poor, the mad, the artist and the homeless. And the streets will be spotless and smell like plastic roses. You can kill this progress or you can kill this cancer. I wanna say I don't give a fuck, but it makes me really anxious.